You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there and welcome to the show. Stu Goldsmith here. I am very proud to be bringing you this episode with Emma Willman from South by Southwest, recorded live at The Creek and the Cave, which is a lovely club in Austin, and I'm very grateful to them for hosting us. Emma Willman is a New York killer. She's one of those comics who is just, she comes out swinging, and she's so funny and so warm and genuine. And I first, when she was offered to me for the podcast for South by Southwest, I had a quick look at her and literally fell in love with her material and her delivery from the first couple of clips. She's huge on TikTok and on socials and what have you. She's very committed to her sort of YouTube output. So if you have the chance before listening to this, watch a bit of Emma Willman's gear so that you know who we're dealing with here. It was such an easy yes for me. I was like, oh yeah, fantastic. And as we will discover, I can't remember if she mentions it in this episode, she had a similar experience of, she's a bit of a kind of not self-help, but like comedy development junkie, as we will discover. And I think she just discovered this podcast about a week before she was asked if she wanted to be on it. So happy coincidences all around. We're going to talk about her totally magnetic material and her angle on gender and sexuality, her origins in comedy with an extremely unusual approach to managing her from one of her teachers. And we'll talk about ADHD, hyper-focus processes, and some really insider stuff on her social media processes as well. All of that to look forward to. No extras on this one, but you can support the show at comedianscomedian.com/insiders to get ad-free episodes, support the show, and get extra content from every show that has it, including some exclusive insiders Q&As that were on Zoom. They're very exciting as well. So without further ado, here's Emma Willman.
Who is dressed exactly like me.
He told me I had to do this, otherwise I couldn't come on.
Thanks so much for coming to the show. And thanks,
thank you guys all for coming here. We appreciate it.
We didn't realize anyone was going to be here because this was a last minute thrown together thing. But you're all clear on the fact that this isn't going to be funny. This is a long, drawn out, boring, dry conversation about comedy process.
That's how I start every show, actually.
Yeah. So tell me, what should we start with? Tell me about South by Southwest. What's your relationship to the festival?
Okay. You guys ready? All right. My relationship to South by Southwest, I came here for the first time last year through a comedy club in New York called The Stand. They were doing a show for a TV network they were starting.
Okay.
I don't really know what happened with that exactly, but I did the show. I flew in from Omaha, did the show, and then I left early the next morning. I ran into the comedy booker of it then, who I'd met before at different festivals, and we chatted, and then he was like, you should come back next year. I said I'd love to, and then I came back this year, and I've been here a couple days this time, which has been lovely. Yes, great.
And how is comedy treating you at the minute? Because one of the things I would like to do, we were having a fascinating conversation backstage, and I would like to try and replicate the intimacy of that conversation, despite
Absolutely.
The fact that there are people here ordering drinks and so forth. So My introductory question with a lot of comics, if I see people in a green room, is like, how's comedy treating you? Feels like a nice open kind of a question.
Sure.
How's it treating you?
How's it treating me? You know, all right.
Good. This is what we want.
I don't quite know. I don't think I'm ever going to say good.
Okay.
I think if I ever say good, then either I've just gone, to me, that would be like, there was either I'm having a total mental breakdown or I've stopped doing comedy. But I think that for me...
Sorry, for it to be going good, you'd need to have stopped. Is that what you said? Okay.
I don't think I will ever say in specific to comedy good. Because to me, comedy is like such a fleeting thing that you can never really, really grasp. So even if it just... There's nothing that I would consider where it's like... But I'll think of it like this. Also, as I mentioned to you one-on-one, this is the first podcast I've done since I've stopped taking my ADD pills, so...
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just going to briefly declare an interest there. I am very recently diagnosed with ADHD.
Oh, really?
I have yet to be titrated, which means that's the process whereby they work out the appropriate medication. So I'm not on any, and I've never taken any.
Well, cheers.
I'm super excited.
Here we go.
Yeah, giddy
up.
Tell me all about it.
That has definitely played a part in comedy for sure. But how comedy's treated me, I just don't think I would ever. I think of it like this. I'll think of it like, you know, like I do love show business and I love comedy. But when I complain about comedy, it'll be like, I'll think of it like we're at like in a sex dungeon and I chose to walk down there and then I'm complaining about getting smacked. But it's like. But I chose to be down there, and I'm choosing not to leave. So my complaints about comedy are all, like, in the context of it's an honor and it's a privilege and I love it.
Sure, yeah.
How is it treating me right now? I'll tell you right now, Stu, not so good.
Okay.
But I say that to say I'm always going to say that.
Yeah, okay. So
you know what
you've
I
done
mean?
There, that's, you've done a disclaimer about, like, we're not digging holes. I'm very privileged.
Yes, I'm not a reliable narrator about it. You know, like, okay. I always think of it, there's always something you could change or turn it into or something more to write about or something. Like, there's just always something more, but that's part of what I like about it.
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that it's never finished.
It's never finished. And I mean, also, it's like, you know, comedy, I think of as synonymous with my comedy career, but I'm thinking of just as comedy overall. It's all right. But, you know, a constant. I'm trying to be more positive.
Okay. Okay, so, and I think we should, I would like to give this some context as well.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people who will go on to listen to this podcast or perhaps people in this room
sure.
will know the kind of your stature as a comedian. You're a very successful comedian, by which I mean, I think you're funny. Those are the only parameters
I appreciate
I
that.
Like, I've seen enough of your clips and your sets on late night that
Thank
I'm like,
you.
Oh, fucking Emma Willman, awesome. Yeah, it'd be great to talk to her.
Okay, well, you know what? Let me sell myself a little better then. Comedy is going good. It really is. I'm going to be in a movie with Bobby Cannavale and Robert De Niro called Inappropriate Behavior coming out. And then this year, thanks, I appreciate that. And then this year, thank you. I have started selling tickets because of online stuff. And that is an honor and a privilege. And I love like getting to like go out and perform for people that have come out to shows. And I love that. So it's really, honestly, I'll rephrase it. It's going great still.
That's great. So now that we've established it is materially going great. Now, tell me with that in mind. Now tell me about why you're not in a great place with it right now.
I'll tell you this. I mean, but and also remember, I'm always going to say that. So, but I feel right now, I feel like I have been writing a bunch of new material and I'm always like really hard on myself about that. But there's so few glimpses of when I really do feel free on stage. Like the last time I had that, I was doing a show. I think it was like, you know, and in New York, you'll do so many sets a week. And then there's just these like glimpses of when you actually feel like where I'll really feel in the moment and I'll say something new. And then I feel like that is so few and far between recently. And so I started seeing a therapist because I think I'm spiritually and emotionally blocked up and it's been prohibiting my writing from being more honest.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that undoes the funk.
Okay, good. Well, put a pin in that. We'll come back to therapy. I want to ask about the number of times you're getting up a week in New York.
Like,
so I think it's broadly understood in the UK, the circuit is very different situation. You might, if you live in central London and you're really going hammer and tongs, you might get up 7-8 times a week.
What did you say it was? Hammer and tongs?
Hammer and tongs.
What is that?
Is that a Britishism that I've stumbled across? You know what? These people are British. They're familiar with hammer and tongs. Yeah, like just going at it hard, like you're in a forge.
Oh, yeah, hammer and
tongs.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I sometimes, particularly now that I've moved out of London, I've got two children, I'm on the circuit
sure.
a bit less. Whenever I hear people, oh, I'm in New York, I'm getting up 3 times a night, I always assume that there is a kind of a consistency of quality to that stage time. And so I'm sort of perversely, I'm kind of excited to hear, oh no, I'm still chasing maybe the same number of moments of glimmers of, oh fuck, this is the thing right now.
Right.
And now I'm back to, okay, now this is grind and grind and grind, and there's another glimmer.
Right. So in New York, you do, the stage time is amazing. You have to work for it for sure, but once you start sending in your avails, which is like when you start like being in at the clubs and like booked there, then you can get a rhythm down for sure. So I'll usually do, I'd say probably I'll do anywhere from like 2 to 6 spots a night.
Okay.
If it's the weekend, that's when you do the 6 and you do, it's like 15 minute set. But for me, when I feel like if a show goes well, it's actually less about whether or not the audience is how it actually goes and more about if I do something new and I'm in the moment with it.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
If the show goes really well, but I haven't done anything new, then I just feel like such a loser.
I'm just going to take advantage of the fact that there are human beings listening to this who are not necessarily comedy professionals. To me, that's clear. I feel like, oh, great. That's like being a level 5 comedian. Mm. To me, when you realize that, oh, how well it goes isn't necessarily connected to how well it goes.
Totally.
That's something that people might not recognize. One might assume that, oh, great, free standing ovations or whatever. You know, it's a huge, huge plaudits.
Right.
You know, just standard. I think you and I were both up in the free standing ovations per 15-minute set. And now they don't know that I'm being dry. but no matter how well it goes, like, the idea of, like, oh, that was great, and people are patting you on the back. Fuck, you smashed it, you crushed, you destroyed. But actually, internally, you might be going, yeah, but I didn't discover anything.
Totally. And I try to be, now I'll just take the compliment and be like, thank you so much, I appreciate that. But I used to be like, I didn't do anything new. And then people, if they're not immersed in comedy, they're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Why have you ruined the praise?
Why have you ruined? Because also, I think people, like, I didn't know that comedians repeated themselves. I remember so clearly the moment I figured that out. I was in Boston, and I was watching this comedian, and he had talked about going to the grocery store the first time I saw him. And then the second time I saw him, I was just at the grocery store. And then the third time I saw him, he told the same story. And I'm like, okay, either this guy is always at the grocery store, or he's telling the same story a lot. And that's when it clicked for me, like, oh, this is a language, and we contextualize the relevance of what we're saying by saying it just happened or whatever.
Sure.
So I'll forget that everybody doesn't know that. So if someone says, good set, and then I'm like, I didn't do anything new. Yeah. And they're like, it isn't all new? Then
yeah,
you're like,
it's
a whole thing, you know.
Let me just want to drill down a little bit more into that idea of doing something new or discovering something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you give me an example from a recent show in the last week or so where you had one of those moments where you have that sort of internal satisfaction of, you know, what was that? Was it like a different piece of phrasing or a different piece of timing or a different beat or like adding a new tag to a joke or stumbling over a new thing that makes you go, oh, that could be that's the first bit of a thread that could be a bit.
Yeah. When that happens, it's like feels like a moment of clarity and it feels so gratifying and hopeful. And I do try to now not have my self-worth really tied to this, but it feels like just a moment of, oh, okay. It's a little bit like, I would imagine it being like, still got it, you know? Like, you're like, you've been married for 45 years, and then someone, like, gives you a little wink, and you're like, oh, shit. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So that's what it feels like for me. And what it was I was on stage at Stand Up New York, and I had done a couple shows that night, and I hadn't done anything new, and I felt really weird about it because I saw a comic at the show right before that. And he was like, good job. I hadn't heard any of that stuff. And then I was like, this fucking guy, you haven't heard this stuff? I've been doing it for 2 years. And he was, I didn't say that to him. I was like, thanks, man. But that's what I thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was like, oh, it wasn't really new. And he was like, I haven't seen it. And I was like, well, you haven't been watching then. Then I went up to Stand Up New York and I was like, I got there and it was an independently produced show. They had a bunch of comedians on it. The audience was tired. Like the show had started at 8 and it was like almost 10 at this point and I was going on last. Beaten, the audience really seemed tired out, and then I went on, pop, 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 got a couple, you know, people were responding, and then I felt encouraged by this one woman in the front row. I said something about my mom being really uptight, waspy, old school New England. For some reason, that really connected with her, and it was like egging me on. And then I started saying all this other stuff about my mom that I had been thinking about, but I had never really expressed.
Yeah.
And I remember going home, because I texted my girlfriend right before I went on stage. I was like, damn, I have to fly out early. I should have not done this show.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, I was like, I'm so glad I did that. That was so productive. I got to start going to Stand Up New York more. And then I also figured out, so it's a tax write-off if you go between comedy clubs, but not if you go from your house to a comedy club. So then I took an Uber from my house to another from the club to another comedy club and then walked home. But so it was a good night. Thanks, I appreciate that. Because I had just figured that out, that little scheme, because I was like, wait a minute, I could just say, now, if the IRS hears this, I'm joking.
That is... That disclaimer is on all of my podcasts.
Yeah.
none of this is admissible.
Right.
So, hang on, what was I going to say? That's one of the things I love. I think that's one of the things that we all find so addictive about stand-up.
Oh,
is 100%. You can be in a shit mood. I don't want to do this show. I don't want to go, oh, God, what was I thinking? There's some other reason. I've got other shit going on in my life. I can't be bothered with this one. And then that one can go on to be the most productive.
Totally. And that's on paper. That would have been the one where it was like, that's where you had the most fun that week. Where it was, I mean, I had done these other shows before that were great. Really great. Just good, great shows, great venues, great other comedians. Everything was great. But that one where it was like had gone on too long, everyone's tired, what the fuck am I doing, all that. That was the one where I was like, yes, thank God for that. That's a glimmer of hope in working on new stuff, which is such an interesting that quest, that obsession for it. I don't know what – it's always like, sometimes I'll be walking around the apartment, I'll just be like, I gotta get work on new stuff, new jokes. Or I'll be always saying, like, I gotta get some new jokes. Like, sometimes I wonder if, like, that is, like, means something else that I'm not even sure what that means yet.
Oh, what? When you get to the walking around your apartment phase, that's symptomatic of something, you mean?
Yeah, like, I'm like, do I really want new jokes, or am I after something else that I'm just calling jokes? Because, like, is it really just about getting new jokes?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe the bear. I don't know.
Can you not recreate, can you deliberately create the conditions? Like you said, that one lady's reaction to that joke about your mum set you off. Yeah, I said mum. It's weird, right? It set you off into the right kind of creative space to kind of bounce on into doing something else. Can you kind of try to create those conditions? Like when it's a new material spot or like a something, you know, a low stakes situation?
I haven't found a way to do it. So what I do with writing to create the conditions for writing, I'll usually sit down, listen to a recording, and just try to start brainstorming around that while I'm also transcribing things.
Okay.
So that is how I'll like try to discipline myself and try to write, but I haven't been able to create it like where I have. I mean, I don't know. Like, I just, as we're talking about, like, I could get like, if it's like, if I need someone to like pep me on, I could get like a sex robot and then program it to say like, to like giggle at certain points to then see if that like eggs me on. You know, I don't know. I'm just spitballing here, but. But you know what I mean?
Can we just unpack that? What the fuck are you talking about?
Like, it'd be like, if I'm trying to recreate the space where that woman is egging me on, like,
oh,
then
yeah,
if
yeah,
I'm
gotcha.
Writing and then the sex, like, I look over and the sex robot's like, ah, I connect with that, ha ha ha.
Yes. Gotcha. Yeah,
then
yeah.
Then I'll be like, oh shit, and then I'll keep going farther because it's like, it's when someone eggs you on, then it's like you get sillier. Or for me, like, I was always someone that was like kind of like goofy in conversation, and then it was me trying to re-harness how I was in conversation. Like, I was a class clown and like.
Oh, I remember on your bio, I think on your website, there's that very brief story about being at school and the teacher having a deal with you.
Yeah.
That if you shut up and paid attention, you get to tell everyone a story at the end of the class.
This is true. 100%.
I love that.
Yeah, I went to a Waldorf school, which is like a really hippie. Did someone else go to Waldorf? It's good to know. Isn't it exciting to know about things? Whenever I know about something, too, I get that excited. Like, oh, I know about that! So Waldorf, if you don't know about it, it's like a very hippie school. They don't have grades. It's very, like, encouraging of arts. And it's, I mean, I wasn't special ed, and I think that being in a Waldorf school was part of why I didn't know I had a learning difference for a long time because there's no grades. So it's like, we're all doing great. And then I got to high school and I was like, there's a problem. Something's not right. And I was like, but I'm good with these crayons. Like, So in the Waldorf school, where it was very experimental, But there's so I noticed this. It was when I started having a lot of problems at home when my parents got divorced and my living situation was totally destabilized. Because it went from being, you know, I'm in one home every night to I live with my dad, my sister lived with my mom, my brother lived with his mom. We were separated. It was this really nasty divorce. So right in tandem with that, I started acting up in class.
Okay.
And as I was acting up in class, the teacher started making a deal with me where she was like, look, you know, I can't fail you because there's no grades here, okay? If I could, I would. But she was like, look, if you don't interrupt the class or you don't make little comments or, like, do silly things, I'll give you 5 minutes at the end of the day or, like, right before we go to recess or some time thing worked out. I'll give you 5 minutes to, like, have the floor and tell a story.
That's such
Isn't
good
that
teaching.
Funny?
That's incredible.
It really is.
That's
I mean,
lots of teachers nodded and spoke their approval.
It seems like a slippery slope, though, because, like, what if you do that for one student, then maybe you should be doing it for all of them, and then you got, like, you know, 15 kids deep, and everyone's like, I want to go home, you know?
So do you, just to stay with that, because I'm fascinated by that.
And I did that, and I remember I would work on a story. I would work on a story probably instead of paying attention. And then I would share the story, and then people started asking for requests. So they would say, you know, they would be learning something about Greek gods, and then they would go, you gonna do something with that later? And then I'd be like, oh, and then I would.
Oh, my God.
And I'm still friends with some of the people from that Waldorf school, because I'm from such a small town, 2,000 people, so very tiny. The school, I think there were 12 kids in, about, say, 12 to 18 kids in each class. So they would combine grades, so there would be just, like, you'd fill up a classroom a little bit. And I'm still in touch with people from it, but they'll bring that up. They'll be like, do you remember that? How the teacher used to do that? Or I guess one time I did a story about meridians. I don't even know what that is, but I have.
Do you ever find them? Do you ever find yourself going, yeah, tell me, what were the beats? I need new jokes.
Yeah. Remind me. I need new jokes. I'm calling up that old teacher. You remember what the fuck I said back in fourth grade? It was. But I have this friend, Sebastian, and when I see him over the years, he'll quote something I said from one of those stories, mm-hmm. which I guess the line was, I have meridians. And so when he sees me, he's like, I have meridians. And it's like, we're still, you know. But that was like the first.
Was your intention with those little mini sets, was it specifically to get laughs? Was it to be interesting or to be liked, or was it to make people laugh?
That's such a good question, and I appreciate it. I don't know. I wasn't cognitive of it at the time, like that I'm going to try to get laughs, but I'm going to assume yes, because I think probably it was a defense mechanism of some sort. Like, that would have, and you know, in the best case, it's yes, because I care about people's time and attention and I appreciate it, and I would hope I would have back then, and that's like a takeaway. Like, at least if it's trying to be amusing, then there's, you know, that's an exchange for their time, which I value. Or so it was probably that coupled with me being silly, because I can't imagine, you know, I was in so much pain at that point. And when I started acting out, I was a really overweight kid. And that's when I first started using a substance as a coping mechanism. And I was just like so like torn up and always like in this like cycle of binge eating. And I can't imagine that I was like looking to speak in a way from the heart, because I was trying so much to numb myself out. So to me, comedy seems like what I would have been trying to do, because I can't imagine me trying to sit with the moment and be like, also, if I was going to authentically share to people before a recess, I would have gotten booed. So if you're the thing standing between the kids going out to I think I probably knew I needed to put humor into it to, like, you know, have their time. Like, that feels like the trade-off. Like, if people come to see a comedy show and they're not coming to see a specific person, the trade-off is kind of like, better be amusing.
Yeah.
That's how I'll think of it. Like, that's like that's the price of admission for having people hear what you're trying to share.
That really is like, and for, like,
I don't know if that, did that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and total safe space if it's not tracking to be like.
No. It's so peculiar. Like, there's over 400 episodes of this show that I've done over the last 11 years, and there are so many completely unique kind of origin stories. I've never come across that before. That's hysterical, really. That, like, if you wanted to create a stand-up comedian, that's quite a good way of. like going the, about it,
yeah,
right?
Sure. The teacher giving me the time at the end.
Yeah, giving you time, and also in a place where you were hurting, and it gave you the opportunity. Like, you can look back at it now and go, you might not have articulated that at the time, but if you can win the affection of the room,
totally.
That's got to be part of the dynamic of...
And I wonder if I was uncomfortable with how I remember getting really uncomfortable with how I looked only in high school, because in high school, that's when people were like, okay, we're supposed to get boyfriends and wear dresses. And in my Waldorf school, that wasn't really part of the narrative. So I don't know if I was uncomfortable with how I looked, but I was definitely starting to deviate from the other girls, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, and I wondered if in the beginning I was trying to, like, warp my body so it was like, less feminine. But I think really it was more just, like, it was comforting to, like, binge eat, you mm-hmm. know? That was – sugar is such a drug for me.
So this is Emma, having the time of my life, as you can clearly hear. Really, really fun to talk to her, and just that lovely combination of zappy and witty and sparkly, and also really kind of candid and thought through. I think this is there's something fun about two ADHD people talking to each other and getting all giddy about the way each other's minds works. So lots more of this to enjoy. Support the show at comedianscomedian.com/insiders if you care to. And you can also catch up with Emma Willman at I Am Emma Willman on TikTok and Twitter. And Instagram, she is Emma Willman. Her website is I Am Emma Willman. So presumably there are other Emma Willman. I'm always interested in the processes that went into, like, which one did she get first? Presumably Twitter came before Instagram. So she went with I Am Emma Willman first. And then on Instagram was I Am Emma Willman taken? That can't be right. Anyway, loads of great content there from Emma. She is someone, as you've heard, who is very committed to putting lots of stuff out and also has a very high turnover rate. So if you haven't already, please, please take the opportunity to get acquainted with Emma's work online. She's just so fabulous. And one of those people, if we're ever on in the same town, I would make a beeline to go and see her. Just a joy. Now, more stuff from me before we go back into this. Spoilers is coming along nicely. By the time you hear this, I will have done a gig at the Extinction Rebellion protest rally that's coming up over the long weekend in London. By the time you hear this, that will be a couple of weeks ago, and I will be in a position to reflect better on it. At the moment, I'm terrified. I'm dabbling my toe in activism, and I think you dip a toe, don't you? You dabble or you dip a toe. Well, I think dabbling a toe makes clear my I think dabbling a toe makes clear that it really is a first kind of a foray to me to do material at a protest gig. So I'm very terrified about that. So I'll let you in on all of that. But remember, go to stuartgoldsmith.com to get hold of the special. This is the big news. The special, I Need You Alive, is now in the wild. It is now freely available at YouTube on the 800 Pound Gorilla website. There's a link to it on the banner from my own site, stuartgoldsmith.com and comedianscomedian.com, and anywhere. I hope now the pipeline is sufficiently set up that wherever you encounter anything of mine online, it's two clicks. It's not even a hop, skip and a jump. It's just a hop and a skip to find the special. It's had 28,000 views, I think, in the first few days, which is enormously gratifying. And if when you watch it, if you enjoy it, perhaps you could choose a positive comment and click thumbs up on that, because then we could get the one really mean-spirited one off the top of the comments list. I wouldn't mind you doing that at all. Who will rid me of this troublesome top comment? So I really hope you enjoyed that show. And also, I wanted to say I won't post Amble at you because various reasons I won't go into. So we'll just finish up the show in a sec. Let me just say this now. I just want to say thanks to everyone, not just the people involved in the special, but also the people who paid for the special over the last couple of months. I hope you don't feel aggrieved that the special is now available for free. I feel like this kind of staggered release is the way that the market's going. But I said as much in the ComCom Facebook group. It's the production company have every right to try and make money from the capital investment that they put into the show. And it's because people like you, if you paid for it, it's because people like you are able to pay for it that means that they make some of their money back, hopefully all of their money back. Time will tell, I'm sure. But what that means is there's more opportunities for the young, good but not yet famous comics of tomorrow. So thank you very much if you've watched that show and commented positively or shared it with your friends or what have you. Thank you very much as well if you had paid for it in advance. I hope I haven't put your nose out of joint by it then becoming free. I think that's just how online releases work these days. But there we are. I noticed as well on the subject of YouTube specials, Luke Heggie has put his show Tip Rat online as well. I'm very much enjoying that at the moment. So that oh, as I'm saying that, I'm like, this is going to get back to Heggie. There's a chance he might listen to this. Hello, Luke. And I know he considers me a sap at the best of times. So the fact I'm talking so cheerily about his work is only going to wind him up. Good. So root out Luke Heggie's Tip Rat, which he's just released. It's a full special. I think I recognise enough of the stuff. I think I saw this show live some time ago. But I think I saw it at Soho a few years ago. It's so funny. I just love his stuff. And I'm happily simpering and smiling about it in a way that will upset him no end. So that's all of that. Let's get back to the rest of this chat with Emma Willman live at South by Southwest.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tell me about your earliest experiences of doing stand-up.
Okay.
Like, what was the... Given that you, by the time, presumably by the time you actually started doing a stand-up gig, you were a very experienced writer.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you knew how to hold people's attention or what have you. What were the circumstances of the first gig you ever did?
So the circumstances for the very first show... Okay, the first open mic I did was in Boston, and this friend of mine had a queer poetry open mic. And I never watched comedy growing up, so I don't know... It was like I saw something. Oh, I remember what it was. I saw a girl doing comedy at a party, and it was like people were upset with her because she made some joke where she used, right when I walked into the party, people were like, this girl just said, I'm going to re-say the word that she said, T-R-A, I'm dyslexic, like, T, you know, Silence of the Lambs, tranny. That's what she said.
Yeah.
So she said that, and everyone was like, she said tranny, like she shouldn't have said tranny. And they were like descending on this girl, and I went over to her, and I was like, what happened? Why'd you say that? And she was like, I was trying to do stand-up comedy. And I was like, oh, shit, what? Stand-up comedy? And that planted the seed. So then I was like, I'm going to try to do that, except for not say that word, at my friend's queer poetry open mic in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. And I remember going, and I went and watched a couple times, but I was too scared. And then I went up, and that first time, you know, I'm not one to say something goes well. I'm always like, I could have changed that, could have changed this. I killed it. I've been tracing the dragon ever since. It's been all downhill from there. But that night, I was on fire. I don't know what happened. It went quite well. I remember, like, walking around that town, Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, afterwards. And people would be like, JP, and people would be like, hey, like you from the fucking whatever. And I was like so pumped about it. So I was like, oh my God, I got it. This is great. Cut to 2 months later, I entered a contest because I was like, I'm ready to be in a contest. So I go from my friend's queer poetry open mic in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts to a comedy contest at Dick Doherty's Comedy Den. And I remember it was the first time I'd ever even been in a comedy club, first time not at an open mic. And I go on stage and someone, right before I even get to the microphone, someone's like, you look funny. And then someone else is like, you look like a boy. And I was like, wait, what? Huh? And I got so nervous, and I don't even remember the rest of it. But I remember afterwards walking around, and I went and bought cigarettes, and it was raining. And I remember just walking in the rain, smoking cigarettes, probably listening to, you know, who knows, some set, Nine Inch Nails or something, just upset. And then I remember going back to my apartment, and I lived in Jamaica Plain at the time, and I must have fallen asleep holding the cigarettes. And there was a leak in the roof that fell right onto the cigarettes. So I woke up in a puddle of tobacco water. And I remember thinking, okay, if I keep doing comedy, I'm going to win that competition someday. And I'm also not going to smoke as a coping mechanism. And then I started doing open mics.
Okay.
I won that competition a year later.
Yes!
Thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah. And I remember being like, and after I won the competition, I think I took some comedy classes in between, but that's when I start really remembering my times on stage, because that's when I started doing open mics constantly. So those were my first two times that I was on stage, were open mic, comedy competition. Then I don't really remember it.
Yeah.
And then I started like clocking, like going out to open mics all the time in Boston. And then I moved to New York maybe 2 years after that. Mm-hmm. Because, and my credit was that I had won this comedy competition at Dick Doherty's Comedy Den. I thought that that would be like, you know, I'm ready to go pro because of that. Little did I know that's not exactly how it works.
No, but, sure. But did you move to New York specifically to go and be a comic?
So my parents hated that I was even, because all of a sudden I was gone all the time. Like I remember whenever I would always be like, I'm going out to open mics, open mics, open mics, open mics. And my mom hated it. She was like, what are you doing? This is weird. Like, I don't think this is good for you. Like, why don't you take yoga or something? And then my dad, I don't really remember how he reacted to it, but he was a little more, neither of them watched comedy at all, but I think they were just both very, like, worried.
Yeah.
And then I was doing all these open mics, doing these bar shows. Oh, and I remember my mom, I was like, I'm going to take her to a show. She comes to the show. It was her, my stepdad. They were the only audience members. And they still did the show. And while I was waiting to go on, there was this comic from Boston named Tom Dustin on stage. And he says to my mom, he's doing a joke about the sex toy, the rabbit. And he goes, lady, do you know what the rabbit is? And she goes, no, but I can assume from what you're saying it is some type of sexual toy. And he goes, what are you doing here? And then she went, I have to be here. My daughter's trying to be a comedian. So here I am. And I was like, fuck. And I remember taking shots in the back because I thought that would, I don't know, make it go by better. And then I went up and did the show. Brutal. And after that, I remember being in the car with my mom and we were silent. We just drove home in silence. And then she goes, we get to her condo. I was living with her. Get to her condo in Cambridge, silent. She's looking straight ahead and she goes, you got to go to grad school. So I moved to New York and I went to grad school for my mom, basically.
Yeah.
And I was doing open mics. I mean, it was like, you know, in New York, the open mics, it's just pandemonium. They're all the time. And I was going to grad school and doing open mics. And I remember I figured out pretty quick, okay, the sign-up game for open mics in New York is intense. Mm-hmm. You go up first if you get there first to sign up. And I was like, shit, people are getting here at like the open mics at 6, people are getting here at 4 p.m. So what I started doing on my way to class, I would go by the club at like 10 a.m., boom, put the list up, and then I would laminate it to the club door, like laminate all around it so that someone couldn't take it off and say like that they started the list. And then I started figuring out who else went to lots of open mics. And so I was like, hey, I'll sign you up for this one.
Yeah.
You sign me up for another one.
Very
and then
nice.
We had this little exchange program going. But I remember this comedy club owner, Marco, like years later, I remember talking to him. And he was like, man, those open mics. He was like, I had to start doing them differently. He was like, some asshole was laminating the mic sheet to the door. So when I had to take it down, it was messing up the door, and I had to go out with a knife every day and cut it off. And I was like, people suck. You know, people just suck.
I want to talk about the kind of the vigor with which you attacked comedy, because
yes.
And because you're a very vigorous person, right? You kind of bite down on the stuff you're saying. I wonder if there's a relationship between your ADHD and the natural coping strategies that we create.
Sure.
And the kind of the strategies that you have to, like, I'm going to throw myself at this as hard as I possibly can.
So I used to always do that with everything. I used to always, like, when I was in, because I think I started figuring out pretty quick where I was like, okay, all right, maybe I won't do so well at school. And I had this really mean stepmom that taught special ed, and she was so mean. It's not my stepmom now, but she would be like, I mean, it's a trigger warning. This is like a little abusive. She's like, you're stupid, and I know stupid because I teach a special ed. She was so, so mean. And she really fucked my head up with that. So I was like, okay, I'm not going to do well in school, so I have to find other avenues. So I was like, I want to be in the music business. So I was obsessed. I wanted to do A&R, and I was obsessed with Jermaine Dupri. Are you familiar with him?
No.
So he is a rapper from Atlanta, but he also had a joint venture with Def Jam. It was called So So Def. Do you remember the song Welcome to Atlanta?
No.
Welcome to Atlanta, where the players play. Do you ever hear Dem Franchise Boys?
I think this is just going to get worse.
Okay,
worse.
Okay, hold on. we know Mariah Carey?
I'm familiar with the work of Miss Mariah Carey.
Well, she dated him for a minute.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and he, you know, he's not a real looker. It's just, he's got a lot of charisma, I think. But anyway, I became obsessed with Jermaine Dupri when I was in Maine, because I was like, okay, hold on a minute. Jermaine Dupri and Master P, because I was like, these two guys, they own the rights to stuff, and I was just curious in their business model. So I was obsessed with trying to do A&R, and my goal was to someday work for Jermaine Dupri. This is why I was in rural Maine, and I attacked that pretty... I mean, I went for it with that.
So
work out, but I tried.
So that's kind of what I'm talking, that obsessional quality.
Oh, I was obsessed.
Well, I think it's those things. Someone phrased this really well to me in a conversation here a couple of nights ago. There's something about the what an effective driver it can be.
Hyper-focus is a big part of
it.
Yeah. Hyper-focus. And then I think for me it was like, I think a lot of it was fear-based, too, because I was so scared of being... I was like... I don't know if it was like... I was just... I was always looking... I think in the beginning, it was me looking to be like, you know, I'm not stupid. I'm going to show everybody that I'm not stupid. And for some fucking reason, I thought working for Jermaine Dupri was the the ticket. I was like, if they see me working with So-So Def, they'll know they were wrong. I don't know what, like, ADD jumps it took to get me there. Whatever. But, I mean, I think he's a real winner. But anyway, so that, I think, was a big part of what fueled it, where I was just, like, scared of marinating and how I felt at the present moment, right?
Yeah, okay.
So I was like, I don't feel good now. What do I need to do to escape this?
Yeah.
And then seeing, like, on TV, especially with, like, music and then rap specifically, which is what I gravitated towards, it was words as a product.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not where you're from, it's where you're at, how'd they get there, words, words, words. So I was really, really interested in that. And that was the first thing I ever hyper-focused on. But I think it was fear that was really pushing it. And then it did become more of a genuine, well-rounded passion, I would say.
And do you, like, that kind of obsessional quality and the hyper-focus of going, hey, there's a system here, you have to sign up early, I'm going to sign up on my way to school kind of thing.
Yeah.
Did you apply that to the actual writing and the creativity and the kind of creation of material, as well as to the kind of pounding the street getting gigs?
No, just the signing up. Absolutely. Like, I've always... I read everything I can find about stand-up comedy writing, and I was actually telling, before we started telling you about, you know, something I Google all the time is comedy writing. I'm just always interested in people's process, and then your podcast popped up about a month ago, and I started listening to it, because I'm just obsessed with hearing about people's comedy writing process, what works for other people, and, like, writing prompts. So I did, yeah.
And how much of that, because like, that's why I do the show, is because sure. I'm obsessed about that as well. But I don't know how much of it, like my attention flits from one thing to another. Mm-hmm. Like I'll interview someone who's a one-liner person, and I'll come away going, that's it, that's the secret. I've got to write one more, you know, more one-liners.
Totally.
Or someone will do long stories and I'll interview them and I'll get really, I've really got to increase the stories. And it can drive me a bit insane sometimes. I wonder whether... Like, what's your reaction to that constant obsessional learning? Are you able to kind of magpie? Do you have magpies in America?
No.
Birds that like shiny things.
Do you have birds
that like shiny things?
And then there's those cookies, aren't there some cookies, magpie? What are they called? Moon pies,
I'm back to the Atlanta rap scene. I've got no idea.
So magpies with the shiny.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, yeah. So... My point is, if you are kind of obsessionally learning, how much of that learning do you feel that you kind of like, looking back, how many of those things did you actually take on and fold into your process? And how much of that was a sort of the froth on top of a kind of an obsessional quality of trying to consume learning?
You really are good with words. Yeah, you say them in
not
very
American
like,
words.
They sound the way you really paint a picture.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think for me, when I hear about other people's process, what it's comforting because I know that someone else is just going through trying to even have a process about creating something. So whether or not I take away, oh, they use this writing prompt or this exercise, that is secondary to me just looking for relating about something that you don't commonly hear some people searching for. That's what to me, so then I feel comfort in that. And sometimes I will try to take, okay, someone says they do, you know, they write for 10 minutes and then they take a walk or they do this, they try to think of 10 things they hate or something. I will try to then do that, but I pretty much usually go back to the same writing process, which is now it's usually I'll try to think of something that seems odd or weird and then I just blow it out of proportion and then I try to incorporate it into my set how it is. And that's what I've been doing more recently. Where I felt I was the most pure was when I first started, because that was when it was like I wasn't overthinking it so much. It was like much more just raw, and that stuff I've then drawn on for like years and years to expand, because I think what started happening, especially when I started doing comedy like professionally, I started thinking, well, shit, I need to get something here to then try to sell it for this, or I need to get this material so then I can go do this. And then that started taking away what really resonated from it. And so then I've just had to just push that to the side and then try to get back to what do I think is funny? What do I think is interesting? What can I present in a way that I think will go with like an overall, like right now I'm really trying to find a thread in like a longer, my act, and just like play around with that.
Some of your, let's just talk about that. So what are your kind of your walking around jokes at the moment? Like what's your kind of, I love that phrase. I've stolen this from my friend Gordon Southern, please, who's an amazing stand-up in the UK, but he just refers to his walking around gear. Do you know what I mean? Like the jokes that you've sort of got, like if you had to do a set right now,
that's the set you
do, right? So what's the thread that you're kind of considering or finding in the stuff that you're doing at the moment?
So right now it's a little bit of a battle, because what I've been wanting to talk about is trying to find ways to deal with life. And I don't smoke cigarettes anymore. I don't drink anymore. And trying to like flit through that and like weave that into my walking around jokes are quitting smoking, ADHD, and sexuality. But I've been having a hard time tying everything together. But the staple is jokes about my dad, sexuality, and porn. Yep.
Your stuff about your relationship with your girlfriend and the fact that you are attracted to hyper-feminine women?
Yes, absolutely.
And the fact of describing yourself as the man one. Yes. I don't want to butcher the bit,
but
Jesus Christ, I was laughing so hard at that stuff.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
What you managed to do was navigate so deftly around these kind of themes of how you're perceived, how gender is perceived, people's expectations of you and of each other, and none of it's kind of provocative, but it's kind of so mildly provocative, but it's really engaging. I'm such a fan.
I really appreciate that. So I always also try to think of it like I never want to be inaccessible to the people that I would want it to be accessible to, which would be like anybody who's like trying to not be a fucking dick. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like if the intention is just, like that's who I would want to be accessible to. And, you know, it's interesting because who it's who's comes out to shows the most, I've noticed, is generally straight women 35 through 42. And it's interesting because it's like that's who it seems to connect with the most, more than I've never been like now. I love to do a gay show. It's great, but it's just I notice sometimes lesbians or queer people will come because they're like, see how I look, and I'm like, oh, of course. But then they come, and that's not who necessarily like will come back show after show.
Okay.
Even though I'm open to it, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, but
it's not who it's been resonating to the most. And sometimes I'll get nervous when I do those shows because I'll be like, shit, is the way I'm presenting my outlook on queer stuff, is that interesting to a queer audience as well?
Sure.
Because, and also I do try to really it is very important to me. When I usually think of, okay, so gender as a socialized reality, race, class, gender, the intersections there. Once we acknowledge it as socialized reality, I'll think of it as like, just, I'll refer more to femininity and masculinity, but I'm very pro. Okay, so what I call, I'm pro man. Like I'm pro man, I'm pro penis man. That's what I call biological men. Like I'm pro. And I want that to be part of it. Like I hate the stipulation, if I'm doing a club and they're like, oh, you know, do you want a local opener? And I'm like, yep, can be anybody. I go, but no, no one, no anti-man. I don't like that. I mean, no, don't be like, it can be within reach. I want someone like fun, good energy, all that stuff. But no, so because every now and then I'd get to a club and they would have a host that would be like, men suck and men do this. If it's coming from a straight girl, I don't mind that as much because they're still accessible to men because they're with men at the end of the day. But if it's like someone that's like, I'm a lesbian and I hate men, that makes me very uncomfortable because I don't know. I'm just am very pro.
Yeah.
Which isn't, I don't know. I'm pro. I'm pro and I want them in the porn. I think so many things do boil back to sexuality in that, like, you know, sexuality and what you're attracted to. Obviously, a lot of times we're attracted to taboo things we don't want in our real life. But I think that with, like, what we seek out in porn, like, does reflect, like, some, like, innate animalistic drive. And in that space, a man, like, a penis man is mandatory in my what I want. And then I also, to really loop it around, that's also what I want in my comedy, to be a safe space for a masculine energy as well.
Yes. And do you, there was something you said a moment ago that just kind of gave me a glimmer. Tell me if this is a wrong sort of direction, but do you ever have the notion or the concern that if you are more accessible to a straight audience than a queer audience, that is a concern somehow, that like that's you somehow selling out or something like that?
Well, here's what the concern is. So I was always like, I'm gonna do that and then not be limiting. But then I have, you know, friends and colleagues who have focused more on being like, I'm gonna mobilize this audience, and they are fucking killing it. So I was like, oh, maybe I should have. I was talking with my girlfriend the other day, and she was like, you know, if you want to just stop right now and just start just addressing lesbians and be like, I'm gay and you're gay and we're fucking gay. She was like, you know, I get a little more creative with it. But she was like, I don't know, maybe next time you see me, that's what I'll be doing. I'm gay, you're gay, we're fucking gay, okay? That's what it is. Gay. But she was like, if you wanted to do that, you could do that right now and focus on that and, like, have that be your thing. And then with your Facebook ads, like, fuck, go right for that. And I was like, I'd rather just not do stand-up, even though, because that's just not what I would talk about naturally, even though I do love that and it's, like, fun to watch people doing that, too. It's just has, you know, it's just not me necessarily. So what I get more scared about is being like, oh, maybe I should, maybe it would be, you mean, selling out in terms of focusing. I don't necessarily think of focusing on straight people, but I'll focus more on like not wanting to just talk about. I mean, I could, like, I love talking about sexuality stuff.
You don't want to ghettoize yourself. Is that what you mean? That you
ghettoize?
Yeah.
Mm.
Like you don't want to. Oh. Okay. Did I say something that's more appropriate
no,
to say in the UK suddenly? I'm detecting some sort of like, I may be in deeper water than I realized.
But there's nothing wrong. Now there's anything wrong with them.
No. So what I mean is, I think you've, I don't know that you've answered the question that I meant, but it was a different and fascinating answer, which is to do with your, like, selling in the terms of, like, selling tickets, that you don't want to be exclusive. Actually, it's your intention to be accessible to everyone, or rather not to be limited by having kind of picked a niche and exploited it.
Right, but no, I'm scared I've made a grave mistake.
But how can you have made a grave mistake when you are successful and functioning? Is it that you're kind of looking at your peers and going, well, I'm not as successful as the most successful of my peers, and therefore it's not good enough?
You know, yeah. I mean, it's also, so I just started doing, when you start doing Facebook ads, you know, and they go, what are you trying to,
then you start doing it, and you go,
yeah, it's a lot. It makes me understand advertising more, because it's like a lot easier if you're like, I want people that are like, you know, 18 through 24 that are interested in RuPaul.
Yeah.
That's a good Facebook ad.
Yeah.
But if you're like, I want people 18 to 24 that are interested in life.
Yeah.
Well, now it's a little less targeted.
Well, this is a
and here's
whole other,
the problem.
I mean, a lot of comics, I think, that will really resonate with them.
True. Because, that's true.
You know, you go, so who are you? What's your voice? What is it you
totally.
Do? And you kind of go, well, I'm a human being.
Right.
And I talk to other human beings. And they're like, who gives a fuck? So is everyone.
Right, right,
you know,
right.
Yeah. So this is kind of leading us into that kind of social media and kind of the distribution of your material.
Sure.
Stuff.
And I wish that wasn't part of it. I really do.
Yeah.
But like, I'll say that, and then I'll have friends that I'll talk to, and they're like, well, I don't really want to do that. And I'm like, you have to. Like, what are you talking about? Narrow down those Facebook ads, but then I don't know, it's a catch 22. I don't know if it hurts the creative process or if it's just like part of, you know, we all have to do things that we don't necessarily want to do.
And there is something
80% of the day.
Like, so you have a following of like 700,000 and something followers on TikTok.
Imagine I knew the exact amount. If I was like 700,002, Stu. I don't know how you missed that second one.
I wonder whether there is something about the way that you use, or the way that one can use social media platforms,
sure.
TikTok, Reels, and everything else, which appeals to the part of your mentality which gets there at 10 a.m. and laminates something to the door.
Well, so that's what I was trying to do when I first went on TikTok. I was going in. I took a class on how to do TikTok videos.
What did you learn from your class on TikTok videos?
Okay, so I took it from this guy who was probably like 18 and definitely lived at home with his mom, which is totally cool. But I remember trying to learn. He sold this TikTok class because I remember seeing TikTok and I was like, what is this? And then I remember being like, I don't know how to do this. And then I was like, okay, I can figure it out, right? So then I typed in TikTok class. This one popped up and I bought it. And then it was this guy, you know, in his bedroom just talking to the camera being like, you can't take yourself too seriously. And I'm like taking notes like, is this my fucking life right now? Like, okay, fine. Also... true. And then I also signed up for his one-on-one mentorship thing. Hey. So I paid him the other $75. And what did I learn from him? Well, you can't take yourself too seriously is what I learned. Can't do it. I learned from that, you know, it was like, you got to post at 10 and then you got to post at 2 and then you got to post at 4 and you got to do 4 videos a day and it's changing. Now you got to post at 1 and you got to post.
Yeah.
And I remember I was doing that in the beginning, but then that wasn't, and the TikTok was building, but then I started noticing that wasn't what people were coming out the shows from. People started coming out the shows from Facebook and so the obsession there was I was editing videos constantly because the amount of videos I was putting out was like, you know, 2 a day. And I was doing it myself. I get to the club, set up my camera, and I had hired editors before, but the turnaround on what I was putting out, it was just too many videos. So I learned different like editing programs. Mm-hmm. And then only in the past, I guess like 5 months now, I have someone that does my social media. And passing up that control felt weird.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm so grateful for it. I feel like I've got like a life back, like a tiny bit, but that hyper-focus really did play into that with the, I mean, because I don't know if you guys or you find this, but it's such social media really lends into a vortex of like obsession and
it does,
you know,
seem to work for people who enjoy it. I think one of the things that is kind of unteachable in a mentorship one-on-one course is that the people who I see do really well on various platforms are people who are naturally on those platforms or addicted to, depending on how you want to phrase it, who like following other people, who enjoy it, who enjoy posting multiple times.
You think, or do you think they're just pretending that?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I'm sure there's both kinds. But right. there's also a third set, which is people like me, which is I'm sort of dutifully doing it. Like I don't have TikTok on my phone.
That's good.
Yeah, because are they sponsor anything here? I mean, it's spyware, right? We know it's spyware.
I mean, it's.
Am I allowed to say that? It's spyware. You should Google that. I'll do you a one-on-one mentorship course, $175.
Yeah. Send me the link after the thing.
But, you know, it's like I'm sort of, not exactly grudgingly, I've just personally now in the last kind of 6 months started to go, oh, I do, like I don't feel so disempowered now.
Sure.
I've got a couple of things, you know, go a tiny bit viral and
absolutely.
Go, oh, this could be really useful. So in terms of the material that you put out on there, are you're kind of mixing, have you got like a calendar of going, here's a crowd work clip and here's some material and here's some material but from a TV thing clipped into the right
I do, but so my tactic when I first started in the beginning, I think I posted like 10 videos and they weren't getting views, so I was like, fuck TikTok, it sucks, you have to twerk, it's a bunch of bullshit. then I started twerking then I posted this video where I made a weird face. I was interacting with a kid in the audience. I go, what? And for whatever reason, that video, all of a sudden, boom, 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 million views, 2 million views, 3 million views, 4 million views. So all of a sudden, I'm like, TikTok's fucking awesome. It's not about twerking. It's about content and quality. And it's just, you know, you just got to find the right thing, the whatever. So that video does well. And then I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. And then I started posting more and I wasn't getting that same success, but I started seeing, oh shit, it's possible.
Yeah.
And then I think I didn't post for like a while over the pandemic. And then I think it was just like starting to do shows again. And I just kind of was like looking around and I was like, I'm going to give it a try. And I just, one of the things I do like about TikTok is it feels like, you can really just, you know, people just swipe. It feels like so much less precious, which I think was a good lesson for me to be like, just get something out there and people can pick it or not pick it. And I also, besides then starting to post on TikTok, like I'm a fan. Like my TikTok algorithm, it's all hip flexor exercises. And I love them. I did some today. I mean, it is curated hip flexor, how to be more mobile, how to get stronger. I mean, I don't think there's a world where I would ever have this curated hip flexor experience if it wasn't for TikTok.
Yeah,
yeah, it's great.
I get occasional hip flexor content.
You do?
Yeah, because of my age. And I also get a lot of cutaway videos of wall plugs being driven into plasterboard.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Interesting.
Really. I love to watch some DIY I'll never do.
Well, that's a very common thing. Like that stuff like that. Or you watch those, like, have you ever gotten on the pimple popping one?
Oh, God.
I know,
no,
I know.
I can't watch that. No.
I'm not on it either, but I have tiptoed around it. And it's just, there's millions of views watching that. And it's just so interesting to be like, wow, this is what, you know, it's satisfying in a way.
What have you gleaned from your most successful clips you would go like, oh, actually, I see now. Like, do you get a sense now that you're like, that one could go, and then it does, and you're like, I was right.
So it's interesting to me when people are like, it doesn't work, it's all crazy. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think it's like, I do think it's a little bit of numbers game, but I think that, you know, it always has to be what's in it for someone else. Why would somebody watch this? What's the takeaway? What's the takeaway? What's the takeaway? If you just start, hey guy, you get right to what it's about for the person right away. Like, that's what it, for TikTok, it has to be, you know, the way the guy said it in the class was, he was like, you got to hook them in the first 3 seconds. First 3 seconds, you got to grab them. So, that I do think is true in term, but it, not in a bad, everyone's like, oh, the algorithm, da, da. But it's like, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, these people don't know you. Who are you to get their attention? Like, for me, I know I'm watching a bunch of good hip flexor videos. So if this one thing pops up and it's not hip flexors, I'm like, and first 3 seconds, otherwise, why would I earn my 10 seconds?
Yeah.
You know, which is maybe not a good model for life, but
the fascinating thing,
and I don't feel that way when I talk to people in real life, just on TikTok. You know,
I wonder, my fear is like, what's next?
I know.
Have we got to hook their attention in a second and a half in order to deliver a 4 second joke?
I know,
like,
it's
where
scary.
Does it go next?
I don't know. I mean, I think the pendulum swings with entertainment a lot. Like, where it'll be like, you know, now my bet, if predicting people's attention were like a stock and it was like, okay, the market's always up and down, I think that, okay, I think that now, you know, the short form content skyrocketing, I'd be like, I'd be investing in some long form content stuff. Okay. But also, I've only made $5 on the stock market once, so maybe don't take stock advice from me. But you know what I'm saying? Like, if it, that's what I think that long, I think that it's not going to be getting shorter and shorter. I think that people are going to start craving deeper, like more stuff.
20 seconds.
20 seconds is what I'm thinking. I think we're going a full 90 seconds over here.
Did it have an effect? Did your success on social media platforms have an effect on how you regard yourself as a comic? Like, if you think that in a club there might be 200 people, you do a bit, they all laugh. That's a nice feeling. You do a thing on TikTok, 500,000 people like it. And you go, do you feel like that has a kind of any sort of effect on your confidence in a bit?
So it's interesting how it, there was this one week where I post, and it was truly scary. I posted these four different clips, and they all, this was maybe last December, each one of them got over a couple million views, and it was boom, boom, boom. And I was literally walking around, listening to DMX, like, this is it. Like, just...
I've totally heard of DMX. I just wanted to make that clear.
He's like, like that. So... I'm listening to that, and like I truly do think that I was so fucking confident in that, but that is not a good, that is not where I want to operate my comedy from at all. Like, I want it to be like in the moment, sincere exchange. But I do remember that I remember being like, this is dangerous. I'm on cloud nine from it, and this is not good because it's not. I at least knew that wasn't gonna keep being the case, but
sure.
For that week, I was I wasn't a monster, but I remember just. It did inform how I was performing because I was like, I was feeling very, very confident. But how it changed with in terms of like how I would feel, there's certain things where if it wouldn't necessarily go well live, but I was like, I bet there are going to be people online that will connect with this. Mm-hmm. Specifically, I'm really into getting my steps right. So if I talk, steps is like you're tracking your steps, try to get 10,000 a day, whatever. So if I talk about that at a show, maybe two people are like, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, Most people do not care about it. Mm-hmm. But if I post a video about that online, there's a huge step getting community online. Mm-hmm. So I noticed that videos about getting steps or IBS, which is also something that I really wanted to talk about. Do they have that? I'd be like, if I do something about IBS, in the audience after a show, maybe one to three people will come up and be like, thank you, like, I have it too. But it's not something that if you're doing at a live show, a bunch of people are going to be like, ow, IBS, you know, so.
But sure.
If I post it online, then specifically to steps and IBS, those do not go well live, but online they do well for me.
That's almost...
Isn't that crazy?
You could kind of... what's the word for like to take something apart backwards? Are there any software developers in?
Reverse engineer.
Reverse engineer.
Yeah.
Thank you. I was so close. When you're... you could reverse engineer what clip might find a community online.
Sure.
By thinking, what bits of stand-up do you have that make one or two people come up afterwards and say, thanks?
Totally.
Because that's a reflection of the fact that a tiny subset are deeply invested.
Absolutely.
And that... that feels like dangerous knowledge.
It is. And I'll try to not, like if it's a show on the road where people are coming to see me, they probably know I'm into steps and they know about the IBS.
Okay.
But... if it's like me just doing a showcase spot in New York, I try to just like, if I'm like working on a joke about IBS or steps, I'll like try to put it in real quick. Cause I just know that people, I haven't found a way to make it relatable to a broad amount of people to make them.
Yeah.
But I'll try to think of it where it's like, okay, why should they care? Why are you talking about this? Why is it worthy of people's?
Could you book like a step getting comedy night? In order to just do 45 minutes on getting steps, to tape it all to an audience who appreciates step getting stuff, in order to then deliver it and chop it up.
Ooh,
it's a good idea, right?
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Go and get obsessed about that. And tell me how it
goes. Yeah, right. I mean, that would be. I would be down to try.
That'd be quite interesting.
Yeah, maybe we could do it while we're all getting steps, which I guess would just be like us going for a walk, but yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I'll try it out.
Lovely.
I wondered about whether you find yourself, like, in the writing process, in the kind of, like you said, that purity that you're looking for, the doing the real thing, making discoveries, feeling like you're in the moment, oh, this is the thing. Is that ever kind of invaded by the notion that, oh, well, this would work quite well online. Maybe I should, almost like I'm chasing the dragon of kind of, hey, that would go off. And totally. Then catching yourself and going, oh, maybe that's not what I'm here for.
So I think if I had started posting things online sooner, then I think that that would have just totally taken over. But since I had been doing stand-up for a little while, I was able to catch it. And then also, since so many people are going through that where they're trying to get clips online, I started going, oh, God, I don't necessarily want to feed into that. Because there was this – I started noticing – it's less in New York because New York is like – the audience just like just won't put up with it. But I would go other places where it was obvious the comedian was trying to get clips. Mm-hmm. And I was like, ooh, that feels uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And there were times where I would like tread into that. And my girlfriend called me. She was like, it was obvious to me. She's seen me do stand up a lot. And she was like, it was obvious to me what you were doing. And I was like
deliberately doing like provocative crowd work, that kind of stuff.
Would be like, say someone seemed a little off in the past, you would just not engage it. When I'm thinking of clips, it's like, what was that? And then you're like trying to get that sound bite. And she called me out on it a couple times and then I dropped it. And now I actually do almost less crowd work than I ever have because I'm like not interested in that. I'll still post crowd work if it pops up.
Sure. But you won't chase it and try and contrive it.
No, because I'm like really scared of it, especially because I see it all the time. Like when I was in LA, I think it was over December, I was blown away by the flagrant attempt at clip getting at some of these shows. Mm-hmm. And
that's just starting to happen in the UK now.
I think it's a little rude because it's like, I don't know. I'm just like, that's rude. Like, especially if people paid for a ticket to then if you're like, if it's so obvious that you're just doing, you know, some people can just do crowd work and it can be amazing, you know, but it's, I feel like it's few and far between and people should know that when they're going into it.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, I'm going to give the audience an opportunity to do some Q&A.
And thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Nice one. Do you mean generally? Yeah.
Yeah.
You're super welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about other strategies. Any other strategies that we haven't covered? Because I enjoy the way your mind works regarding I'm going to get there and laminate. You know what I mean? Any other kind of either creative or industry-based strategies for things? Which, or even actually something we haven't particularly talked about is what happens when it, like how you cope when it doesn't work, how you cope with the tougher times. We talked briefly the other night about therapy.
Sure.
Can you tell us, please, that thing you told me about the therapist who told you compare and despair?
Oh, I hired a life coach. This is before I did comedy. I got a life coach, and she told me compare and despair, and I thought it was something that she had come up with.
Yeah.
And I was like, this woman's a genius. I can't believe it. That's exactly right. If you compare, then you can despair, and then that's what it leads to. And I would tell people, oh, I just got this life coach, and she told me compare and despair. And people were like, yeah, okay. And then I got this therapist, maybe like we're talking like 7 years later, and I was like, well, I had this life coach who once said compare and despair. And she was like, yeah, that's a great thing, but she didn't come up with that. And I remember being like, what? Like, I paid that woman $800 then for nothing. It's such an expensive life coach. But you know what? And then you made a good point where it was like, it was a great thing for me
to
hear.
It still worked. Even if it was like, she didn't say, hey, here's a thing I came up with.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, sure.
Right. Compare and despair. So I would say I try to focus on stuff now is I've really tried to just get back to like being like, hey, this is a real long game and trying to just do stuff that I feel proud of. And then also, and that's helped with like acting too. Because when I first started doing acting stuff, I was just, this is very like symbolic for what my process had been, which was I'm going to take a bunch of acting audition classes. And then I got cast in a couple things and I was like, I don't know how to act. I don't know how to act. This is a goddamn disaster. I don't understand the camera placement. I don't understand being in a scene with someone that's not reading the lines for your acting audition. I don't know how to do that. This is fucking not good. So I was like putting the cart before the horse for sure. And so now it's like, you know what? Let me. I think I had tried to reverse engineer it, which was maybe a coping skill with dyslexia and ADD, of being like, okay, I'm not going to get, it's going to be hard for me to learn these certain subjects, so how can I like maneuver around things in a way to then create a system for myself? I think that my self-will had run riot a little bit in, I'm going to create these systems, but then they got blown out in a way where it's like, hold on, you don't always need to do that, and also you need to learn how to act before you learn how to do the audition, which I think is, I think a lot of times, at least for me, like, or I would say in, you know, this quick clip culture, we're looking for ways to get the thing before we know how to do the thing.
Yeah.
And I've had so many friends that have asked me, hey, I need to get an acting agent. How do I get an acting agent? I was like, have you ever taken an acting class? No, I got to get an agent. Then I'll take the class. And I'm like, no, it's like a real estate agent trying to sell a house, but you don't have a house. You're like, well, you sell it and then I'll get the house. And then we're like, no, sure. This isn't how it works. So a system I have now for like coping with all this, be like, I'm going to focus on the thing and then the steps after that, and how I focus with things not going well, it's a mix. It's a real mix. You know, in the past, it was drinking. It was being sneaky. It was maybe, you know, porn or being sketchy, being a bad partner. Mm-hmm. In terms of like, you know, me in the past, I would do something sketchy, talking to people when I'd be in a relationship in a flirtatious way, you know. So that didn't work. My way of handling stuff did not work because I was very unhappy. And then now, this does sound silly to say because it's like the obvious stuff. For me, I'll try to take something that doesn't go well or goes well almost the exact same way because it's just like part of, okay, this is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's like, this is what we're, good, great, good info, bad, great, great info. Okay, what do I can only control what I can control. How can I gauge my, what I was able to do in that? And then if something is upsetting, being like, okay, I'm going to feel this. And I am going to try to just be like going for a walk and listening to Jock Jams, like, be like, I'm upset. I'm sad. You know, I've got some friends and then my girlfriend, or I call my mom. I like, you know, over the years I've developed a close relationship with my mom. So if something's upsetting, this is one thing that helped me out. Like if I was feeling jealous of someone, I'll try to think, stop. Okay. Would I want to change places with them? Would I want to say, I don't want my mom anymore. I'm going to have their mom right there. No, deal breaker. So I'm me. I'm stuck with me because I wouldn't change it because I wouldn't want to change out my mom or my girlfriend or my friends, or you know what I mean? So that has been a coping skill because it's like, oh, you might be like, I want that. But it's like, but would you actually change place with them even if it meant getting that thing? No.
That's great.
And that helps. That does help. And then I try to not have it be something that will then make me feel bad afterwards. You know, like if I'm like, because a big one will be like, oh, like just being like, I'm going to like walk around and eat tons of sugar. Like sometimes I will use that like, oh, I'm going to get this delectable treat, but I will try to not overdo it. So just trying to like keep it within the self-regulation. And this is also another thing that's been a big coping thing is really focusing on being like, okay, sleep is precious. I need to try to not be so worked up that I can't sleep. Cause there would be like times where I would just be like, thinking about career stuff and constantly not sleeping. So now that focusing on prioritizing sleep has also helped.
That's great. And that's so great to hear because you're, like you said, you're doing all the stuff you're supposed to do. Like
I'm trying
all of that
to.
Stuff. That's great.
Trying to.
It's frustrating, isn't it? When you end up doing the stuff that you've been told for ages.
I know.
When you're supposed to, fuck
oh
off.
Oh my God.
And you do it and you're like,
right.
I'm happier.
I actually do feel better. Yeah. Like with the drinking more water and now I get less sick and I'm 37 and like it took me up until like 5 months ago to be like, you know what? I was a little dehydrated. Okay. You were not. Now that you point it out, could have caused some problems.
Someone told me, I can't remember where I heard this a couple of years ago. Someone said, oh, basically, what it is, there's the key to emotions. Mm. If you're angry, you need to eat something. And if you're sad, you need to sleep. And I was like, I fucking can't be that simple.
Right.
No, it's pretty much that simple. A lot of the time.
Totally.
Yeah.
But it's simple theories for organisms that are complicated. So you know what I mean? So it's like we have to come into them in our own way, I think.
Very good. I like that sentence. Did you finish grad school and what was it for? And how's
so
your
I went to grad school for media studies and I finished it, but by like the fucking skin of my teeth. What is that saying?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. I mean, it was because it was like that's when I was like really drinking a lot and totally focused on comedy. So I had to go back and do a summer program. And also I cheated because I had to get a math. I had to take a math class and I couldn't do it. So I bought I took a math writing thing and I ended up buying it online and then submitted it. I don't know how I didn't get caught, but they still haven't sent me to my degree. So
none of this is admissible.
Yeah, if you're the IRS and you're listening, it's not true. But they had whatever. So I did graduate. I'm just saying that all to say I don't know if I necessarily 100% deserve the graduating, but I did graduate. It was in media studies. I did an independent study on celebrity construction and monetization in the United States as it relates to capitalism. That was my independent study that I created. And I you know who was a big part of it? I used Jermaine Dupri. I had like a section on him to bring it up. I know, right? Because in his, he was part of constructing, you know, he managed Little Bow Wow. He's bringing people to the forefront. They go away. He's still there. So, and there was a reason for that. But I, undergrad, I was lucky enough to study, like, look at, like, the way America, like, or, you know, the socialization of, like, race, class, gender, these socialized realities. And I was like, oh, shit, that's like kind of how celebrity construction works. So that's what I ended up, like, focusing on and studying. And then my mom, when I graduated, she was like, what did you study? And I was like, I don't know, but I got to stop drinking. And she was like, Emma. And then, Emma, stop looking at porn on my computer. It's weird. I got caught looking at porn on her computer right around when I graduated. Not in real time, but like the day after graduation, she was like, I think your sister looked at porn on my computer last night. I was thinking it was you, but it was straight porn, so it has to be your sister. And she was like, it's weird she did that the night of your graduation. She wasn't even here. She must have snuck in, watched porn, left. That's crazy. And I was like, so we were still going over that when I when I got to the graduation. She was like stuck on, like, what happened? But, she came to a show in Tampa, which was a really nice moment for us because she hadn't been to a show where, like, people had come out and bought tickets for it. And that was really nice. And she was so, like, she was like, what are these people doing? Who are these people? And I was like, shh, you know, we've got to act like this is normal. And she was like, okay, but who are these? And she was like, I asked people in the bathroom. I said, I'm Emma's mother, so that's why I'm here. Who are you? And I was like, well, don't do that. And, but she got a real kick out of it. And it was like a cute moment. It was a nice moment for us. And now she's in Florida, and I'd say she's pretty stressed out. She also started doing a workout class 3 days a week, and she's pretty happy with that. So pretty good. Kind of same old, but she seems like a little bit happier, and I don't know what the deal is with that, but God bless, you know. Thank you.
Last question. Are you happy?
I'm pretty, you know, I'm not bad. You know, I am proud of myself for not, like, I'm proud of myself. Yeah, I am. You know, that therapist that called out the life coach, the one, that therapist, she said, she was like, people are trying to be happy, and I'm paraphrasing, but she was like, people try to be happy all the time, but what we should go for is more like contentment. Because if you try to be happy all the time, you're going to be sad. And I remember when she said that, I was like, true. So it's like when I try to be happy all the time, that's a little bit scary too, because then I'm like trying to feel good all the time. We can't feel good all the time. We got to drink our water. We got to try to sleep. We got to remember to take our fucking magnesium, do the dishes. So am I happy all the time? No, but that's good because I'm not supposed to be. But I'm more content than I've been before.
Emma Willman.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you guys for coming out.
So that was Emma. Thanks to her for coming along. I had so much fun meeting her and enjoying her work, and I really enjoyed that conversation. You can find her iamemmawilman.com or at iamemmawilman, unless you're on Instagram, in which case she is simply at Emma Wilman. That was not easy to say. You can support the show at comedianscomedian.com/insiders or go to stuartgoldsmith.com to find out everything you need to find about me, including that clever little link tree thing that tells you when my previews are coming up. I'm previewing at Top Secret in London. I'm going to be at the Mac Comedy Festival. I presume that's sold out now. It was very close recently. I'm also going to be in London, Leicester, Leeds, Northampton and Cardiff and other places besides, adding more as we go. That'll do for now. Thanks to Emma. Thanks to Nathan for producing the show. Thanks to Moz. Lots of love to Moz for doing some great sterling work under duress. Not under duress, under hardship, and also under duress. I'm cracking the whip at Moz. Thanks to you for listening and sharing the show and following it and promoting it and, you know, telling people about it using words in ears. Thank you. That'll do. I'm off. Goodbye. That goodbye was weird, wasn't it? Why did I shout goodbye at you? Ooh, bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.